Lame duck, PFAS, foster care, and artisans of Michigan. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We'll hear from our political commentators about a couple of bills from lame duck, which would restrict agencies.
It basically says when it comes to all regulations, Michigan's going to defer to the federal government.
Michigan is finding PFAS contaminants in water because it's actually looking for the chemicals.
Looking as I am at the country as a whole, there are not a lot of states that are doing more.
When the state separates siblings.
Siblings have everlasting bonds that shouldn't be destroyed by a broken system.
And forget online dashboard measurements. Your local school might be getting a letter grade.
This lends a bit of clarity and transparency and provides parents and schools, for that matter, additional information about themselves.
All that, plus a cocktail from the Cheers team. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan could begin giving letter grades to schools. Your local school would be given an A to an F grade. The bill was introduced by Representative Tim Kelly, and he joins us now. So why are letter grades better than how we determine school performance now?
Well, I think that there's a mixed bag out there about how we report schools, and I think this lends a bit of clarity and transparency and provides parents and schools, for that matter, additional information about themselves.
This would not just be one grade for the entire school, but grades for different categories. What kind of categories are we talking about?
We're talking about proficiency on state exams. We're talking about growth. We're talking about how well they do with it, English as a second language learners. We're talking about graduation rates, those kinds of things.
And what goes into determining those grades? I mean, how do you calculate those?
Well, how well does a student do on state assessments? How well they do on local assessments, things like NWEA, that'll measure growth.
I guess what I was getting at is, you know, we've got these rankings that we see. Are we going to be grading on a curve, or are we going to be grading a...
No, it's not something on the curve. There's going to be some comparisons to other, how well you do as compared to a like school with like students, information like that.
Okay. I read an opinion piece in Bridge Magazine, and it indicated the State Board of Education does not support your idea of a letter grade because the board thinks it would lead to sanctioning schools with the greatest challenges, such as poverty among the students.
Yeah.
What do you make of those concerns?
Well, I first of all, I think this is should not be seen as something punitive, but as something that's instructive. If there are no consequences, by the way, with this, even if there's a series of Fs in a school, there's no consequences. Hopefully some will be developed, but part of the legislation that we passed along with this was to remove or repeal the school language closure. So even if you have a series of these Fs, currently there's no ramifications for it.
What kind of ramifications do you think there should be?
Well, I think that if you have a series of failures in school, that schools should close. We had this argument. The governor and the state superintendent at the time, the late Brian Wiston, decided they didn't have an appetite for closing schools, so they came up with this partnership mechanism to work around the law, and that's what we currently have.
Let's talk about Detroit for a second. There was legislation in 2016 that bailed out the Detroit schools, and that also required the district to create its own A to F grading system. And the district was set to release that plan next week. Superintendent Nikolai Vitti was on our show yesterday, and he says your bill will undermine all that work that they did and that no one from the legislature engaged with him or anyone else at Detroit about this bill. Did you have conversations with anyone at Detroit Public Schools?
I've had conversations with representatives of the DPSCD or the CEC on their work that was going on. It was interesting to note, but it was irrelevant. The law that we passed, the bailout of Detroit, said that Detroit will have an A to F if and until the date that a statewide system comes in. Everybody knew that. Everybody was aware of that legislation. We passed new legislation that supersedes what they're doing. Look, if they want to continue with their own A to F, so be it. Nobody's stopping them. But there'll be a state overlay on top of that. And I think it'll be interesting to note how each one is perceived. I'd like to talk a little bit about this interview you had yesterday with Representative Vitti, because he makes my point for an A to F letter grade system. He says in Florida that he worked under, it improved the system. He, on his own A to F, has talked about the What he was looking for was to help move the needle in improvement with his own A to F. They're making my case for why the state needs an A to F system. Listen to what he's saying. The whole Vitti conversation is absolutely the hypocrisy at its highest. I mean, he talks about the five-letter grades that we're going to give out. He's going to do a summative grade. I can tell you this. I would have started with a summative letter grade. The ed community fought it, didn't want it. So the bill that we promoted was a compromise. It was a say, okay, we won't give you a letter grade. We'll provide a letter grade within four or five options. Now you got Vitti arguing that point. He lived under a summative letter grade in Florida. The hypocrisy on the left and in the ed community is just absolutely off the charts.
When you talk to your constituents, what do they think of this idea?
I think parents want to see this. Parents want additional information. People want clarity. I think for too long we've tried to mask poor performance, and it comes through a cacophony of different kinds of performance indicators that we've had. We used to have an A to F system back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Then we went to this color-coded system. Now we're a state-approved dashboard with lots of information, but ones that parents have to quite honestly ferret out for their own to really get through the mask of information.
Representative Tim Kelly sponsored a bill that would give schools a letter grade, A to F, and five different categories, much like the schools give students grades. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We wanted to take a moment to look at some of the more controversial legislation pending or passed by the lame duck legislature. Joining us now via Skype is Gongwer editor Zach Gorchow. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Lester.
So let's look at some of the ballot initiatives first. The legislature took up the proposal to increase the minimum wage and mandate earned sick time. What did the legislature do with that as it amended it?
Well, on the minimum wage side, they really took the guts out of it. In a lot of ways, they extended the period where the minimum wage would rise gradually instead of it hitting $12 an hour by 2022, as the initiative stipulated, it would be 2030. That's really no change at all because there's already an inflation adjuster in the minimum wage. It probably would have hit $12 an hour by then. Anyways, they also quite significantly returned tipped workers to a lower minimum wage. It would be 38% of the regular minimum wage. The initiative called for tipped workers to be brought up to the regular minimum wage by 2024. On the paid sick time front, instead of earning 1 hour of sick time for every 30 hours worked, it would be 1 hour for every 40 hours worked. And there would be a maximum sick time that you could earn of 36 hours in a year instead of 72. And then very significantly, those working for employers with less than 50 employees would not be eligible under the changes. Under the initiated act, they are eligible.
And of course, those folks who put together that ballot initiative say they're going to be back in 2020. Let's move on to the legislature wanting to tweak the Promote the Vote initiative that was passed by voters. What changes are being proposed there?
To be fair, I would not necessarily call them changes. Remember, Proposal 3 was a constitutional amendment, so they can't change it without amending the Constitution, which takes two-thirds majorities in the House and Senate, plus affirmative vote of the state. What they are doing is trying to fill in areas that weren't defined in the proposal, and the big one there is how same-day registration would be handled. So if you decide you're going to register, you haven't registered to vote, and it's Election Day, and under the constitutional amendment, now you could do that. You could register to vote on Election Day instead of having to do it 30 days before the election, like previous law was. The constitutional amendment didn't say how that would be done. The bill that's moving says, if you want to register to vote on Election Day and vote on Election Day, you got to go to your local clerk's office to register and then take a receipt to the polling place to show your proof of registration. Most of the states that have same-day registration let you register at the polling place itself. So this would be quite a bit different than how most states do it.
Let's talk about the Voters, Not Politicians constitutional amendment. That was the anti-gerrymandering proposal approved by the voters. It also is subject to some tweaks, let's say, from the legislature. What do they want to do?
Again, they can't change the proposal because it is a constitutional amendment, but they can try to fill in areas they think the proposal doesn't define. And the main one they're really looking at is to spell out what it means to be affiliated with a political party. You know, the people who would serve on the commission to oversee the drawing of the maps are supposed to, you know, four of them are supposed to be Democrats, four of them are Republicans, and five of them are independents. So the bill attempts to define what does it mean to be a Democrat or a Republican, and how do you, you know, what would it mean to be an independent? The issue here is the Voters Not Politicians group that passed the proposal says the proposal is self-executing and thus cannot be affected in any way by statute. So if that bill does pass and get signed into law, I'm sure there will be a fight over that. The bill itself is not particularly dramatic, but I think what's happening here is Voters Not Politicians wants to prevent the proverbial camel's nose under the tent, that if this goes through and becomes law, what else might those opposed to the commission idea try to do in the future?
There are a couple of bills that would limit the powers of the incoming governor, secretary of state, the attorney general. The Democrats are calling this a power grab by the Republican-led legislature. What kind of changes are being proposed here?
Well, for the secretary of state, the power over campaign finance would be taken away and put in the hands of a new bipartisan commission. It would be a huge change. The secretary of state has always had power over regulating the campaign finance system. Then you have another bill that says the House and Senate would have an automatic right to intervene in a state court in a case involving state law or the state constitution. Right now, that's really reserved to the governor, the governor's departments, and the attorney general. So you could have a situation like with the repeal of the prevailing wage law, where the governor and attorney general decide, you know what, since this has been sued and the constitutional challenge is being made, we could just decide to settle this and kind of settle it in the way that the unions would like, or drop our defense of it because we agree it's unconstitutional and then thus unenforceable. This would allow the legislature, still under Republican control, to intervene in court and defend the law in the way they see fit and make the arguments that perhaps the attorney general and the governor's attorneys will not make.
That is Zach Gorchow. He's editor at Gongwer News Service. One more week, Zach. You might get some sleep after that.
Yeah, it feels like one more year, not one more week. We'll see.
All right. Thank you much.
All right. Thanks, Lester.
We recorded that interview earlier, and Zach called to say he misspoke about the leave time. The bill, as signed by the governor this afternoon, will give workers 1 hour of paid sick time for every 35 hours worked, with a maximum of 40 hours a year. Stay with us. We'll be back with more Stateside right after the break. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We search high and low for Michigan artisans. This time we found some in a shop tucked away in a light manufacturing area west of Ann Arbor.
Hey, I'm Mike Cameron. I'm the CEO of Dogmite Games.
And I'm Michael Konis. I'm the CBO of Dogmite Games.
What does that even mean?
I don't really know.
Mike and Michael are the creative forces behind Dogmite Games. So how did these two get into this?
Mike and I have known each other for almost 12 years, something like that now, and we game together. So when I met Mike with some mutual friends, and we started playing, you know, kind of nerdy games, and we were sitting there one night, you know, having a beer, kind of brainstorming, like, wouldn't it be cool to make a game that our friends would like? And it just so happened, we live out in Pinckney on the Chain of Lakes and do a lot of boating, so we thought, hey, let's make a game about, you know, being on a pontoon boat, drinking some beers, and this half-baked idea turned into our first card game, Lake Billy, and we spent, how long did we spend on that?
Way too long. Way too long.
Way too long? You were probably, what, we took a year to draw all those,
yes,
those cards?
Yeah, I think I did 150 illustrations, had never done digital illustration before,
yeah,
and kind of learned along the way of creating.
Yeah, and so this half-baked idea kind of turned into our first published game. Which was great. I still
the game
have.
Was it? The game was
the
terrible.
The game was awful. The experience was good. I think we still have 200 in a closet here somewhere. And after that, we created a second game, which was Livestock Uprising. And kind of as an afterthought, we made these small wooden accessories for the game. We're like, you know, we crowdfunded it, and we were like, oh, we have this thing, and let's do something extra. And we ended up with, you know, these little wooden pieces. And lo and behold, the wooden stuff was far more popular than our games.
As I understand it, you found out people were pulling out these wooden card holders and throwing the games away. Is that right?
We don't know if we don't have evidence of that directly, but that's what we think happened based on some of the reviews
and
of the game.
That's complimentary in its own way, right? So we did a bit of a pivot there. I've been a hobby woodworker most of my adult life, and so we started in my garage. To my wife's chagrin, we kind of walled off a spot in the back, probably what, 600 or 700 square feet?
Tops, yeah. I think it was 12 by 40, maybe?
Yes.
Maybe?
This really tiny spot, and we started, taking a real look at this. And it turns out that it was, what we were making was popular enough that we could do it. We were like, hey, we got something here. And we were working nights and weekends and things like that.
Well, what was your day jobs before this?
Oh, I'm a programmer by trade.
I was an art professor at Eastern Michigan University.
It's been a bit of an interesting stretch for us.
There have been very few stories about artisans where I've been so out of my element. I'm not a gamer. I mean, I've played Apples to Apples and Monopoly with the kids, but that's about it. So this idea of dice with more than six sides and dice chests and dice towers, storage chests made of hardwood, some with inlays, 3D sculpting, engravings, it's a little bit more than I was aware even existed. My game boards are cardboard.
Well, we're kind of brutes, and I'm a terrible klutz. I don't think we can make anything that's kind of light and not strong enough to deal with it. We game ourselves all the time still. And we want something that's kind of heirloom quality that's going to put up with people spilling drinks on it at the table, and you can throw in your backpack and use once a week for years to come. And our stuff's heavy. It's sturdy.
I was looking around at the hardwood. I mean, you've got some quality stuff there, too.
Yeah, and Mike and I are both creative people, and we tend to really try to kind of push the envelope. So, like, some of the stuff that you've seen, we're doing, like, the 3D sculpting, and Mike mixes his own pigments, and we'll stain wood purple.
Yeah, art professor.
Yeah, exactly. And we often say, we're not your grandfather's woodworkers, so we like to kind of really push the envelope of what that is. And we get ideas from our customers and from the people who work here, and we'll take anything and meld it together and come up with something really unique and almost like a little artistic, right?
Yeah.
Not only is Dogmite Games often crowdfunded, it's crowd-directed to a certain degree.
We have a lot of fans out there, and we adore them. We have our own forums now, and they throw us ideas. So anything new is really the bestseller at any moment. We had the Component Collector, which was an amazing hit. We crowdfunded that as well. I think we sold over 5,000 units in about 28 days. And we'll be making those for a while yet. And that's part of our main process of production right now is producing those and getting those out to our Kickstarter backers.
As the business has grown, Mike and Michael spend less time hands-on on the pieces they sell, but that frees them up to be more creative and teach others how to do the woodwork.
Mentorship is part of our DNA here. We want everybody in the shop to be able to do every job in the shop. So we cross-train everybody in every position and every skill set, part of their moving from apprentice to woodworker, and it's vital here. We need it.
Annie Baker is one of the artisans working in the shop.
I was an art major back in college, so it was something that I thought, it wouldn't hurt to hone my skills. I need a job, so we'll see what happens. And it turns out the community was really great, and I really enjoy doing this. I love working with my hands, so it was awesome.
Is woodworking a skill that was a hobby of yours or a pursuit of yours prior to this?
No. Before this, I had never done any woodworking. I was a printmaker, so I did, relief cuts. So I had some experience with how to chop some wood down, some sanding, but never to, this degree. I've never built a box before. I've never had to plane things or mill things down. So it was a lot of new things I had to learn to come in here. But, yeah, no, I love it, and I'm happy I did it.
Michael Conis says one of the things that makes Dogmite Games so popular is the flexibility. There are so many choices available on stock, or you can submit your own ideas, and they can probably make it work.
I think one of the things our fans like best about our company is that it feels like it's a custom wood shop for whatever it is that you want. It's based on the character that you play in a game or the games that you play at your table. You can get something that's thematically ideal for what you want. Pretty remarkable, and that's one of the things we really hold to going forward.
Michael Conis and Mike Cameron are the co-founders of Dogmite Games, makers of custom tabletop gaming hardware, and our latest Artisans of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. PFAS is a family of chemicals that's been found in drinking water sources in several places around the state. Today, we're talking to an expert on how to clean up PFAS chemicals. Tom Bruton is a scientist at the Green Science Policy Institute. Welcome.
Hi, Lester. It's good to be here.
So we understand that these chemicals don't break down easily. They're so-called forever chemicals. Does that have anything to do with how difficult they are to clean up?
It does. There's a real connection there. You know, because PFAS are so persistent, a lot of the tools and tricks that engineers have for cleaning up water contamination don't work as well for PFAS. So, for instance, one technique that is often a good technique for cleaning up a contaminated site is to let natural bacteria or microorganisms that are there eat up the contaminants. But that does not work with PFAS because they're such stable molecules. There are no bacteria around, at least that we've found yet, that can break them down.
You researched one particular method of PFAS remediation. It's called in situ chemical oxidation, and it's effective on water. How does that work?
You know, you can think of it as a way of introducing a good chemical underground where the contamination is to react with that contamination and detoxify it. It's a little bit like adding bleach to your laundry. Bleach is an oxidant chemical. You add it to the laundry, it reacts with the stains in your clothes, the stains go away. The bleach doesn't leave anything too nasty around. So in situ chemical oxidation is a similar process where we introduce an oxidant underground and hopefully detoxify the contaminants.
How effective has it been?
For certain kinds of pollutants, you know, some more run-of-the-mill pollutants, like you might have dry cleaning solvents from dry cleaners or gasoline from a service station, in situ chemical oxidation is really effective, and it's used all over the country all the time to clean up sites. But what I found in my research was that it's no surprise, it's not as effective for PFAS because these compounds are so stable. What I found is that in situ chemical oxidation can work sometimes to break down some PFAS, but in order to get this process to work, one has to pump a lot of chemical into the ground and use really harsh conditions. So for all but the worst contaminated sites, it's not going to be the silver bullet.
Hmm. We know the Air Force is using some kind of a system on the plume of contamination in a groundwater source in and around the closed Wurtsmith Air Force Base. How do you clean up a plume of pollution? I mean, as I understand it, they suck the water out of the ground, and they do something to it, and they put it back into the groundwater.
That's basically right. You know, in an ideal world, we would be able to clean up all of the contamination that's in the aquifer. You know, we would be able to clean up all of the pollutants in the vast amount of water that's underground. But it turns out that that's really hard. And so what happens most of the time is that we focus on the water that's coming out of the aquifer, like you said, like water that is water that we can pull out with pumps and then run it through some sort of treatment process. Most of the time for PFAS, what's happening is that water is being pumped out of the ground and run through a carbon filter, sometimes another kind of filter called an ion exchange filter or reverse osmosis filter, and then that water is cleaned and often pumped back into the ground, sometimes released into a stream or a lake.
So if you've got a big plume like we have around the Wurtsmith Air Force Base or some of these other sites, are we looking at filtering groundwater for years or decades, or how does that work?
I'm afraid the answer is that it's going to be a long time, yes, because the fraction of the total amount of groundwater that's being pulled out by these pumps is small. And in order to pump out all of that groundwater that's down there, that I think it's a plume that's, you know, a half mile long or something on that order, it could possibly take decades. You know, these are called pump and treat systems, and there are pump and treat systems that have been running for decades to clean up contaminated plumes. It's not a fast solution.
So we're talking about chemicals that don't break down, so we can't do that. It takes forever to clean them up in this fashion. It sounds like this is going to be a tough job ahead of us.
I think so, yes. And the last I've heard is that the Department of Defense has budgeted or estimated that their liability for cleaning up PFAS runs into the billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Some of these PFAS chemicals are called long chain and some are called short chain. What does that all mean?
Well, it has to do with the amount of carbon atoms that are in these chemicals. The original PFAS that were produced and used for a long time throughout most of the 20th century were so-called long-chain PFAS. These are chemicals that, for the most part, contain 8 carbon atoms all attached in a chain. And this is chemicals that you've heard of, like PFOA and PFOS. Now, as scientists discovered that PFOA and PFOS were persistent and were showing up, you know, all around the globe in polar bears, in the blood of most Americans, and that they had toxic effects, the manufacturers, with some arm twisting by EPA, decided to phase them out. And what they switched to were chemicals called short-chain PFAS. So literally, they have a shorter carbon chain. The reason that they switched to these is that the short-chain chemicals are less bioaccumulative. So they don't stick around in our bodies as long as the long-chain chemicals. And that is a good thing. But that alone, you know, I would say is not enough to say that this is green chemistry or that these are benign chemicals, because a chemical can still have toxic effects even if it doesn't have a long half-life in the human body.
The reaction in Michigan by a lot of citizens is, what in the world is going on? Here we have another pollutant in Michigan. And we're finding a lot of these PFAS contamination sites because the state is actively looking for them.
Right.
So it looks like Michigan's suddenly a hotspot for PFAS, but most states are not looking for them, so they could have just as big of a problem. So if you were to grade Michigan's efforts in tackling the PFAS contamination problem, A to F, what kind of grade would you give the state?
Oh, that's a tricky question. I've followed the news some, and I do think that Michigan is doing more than nearly any other state to, you know, uncover stones, figure out where the PFAS are, and start to address it. On the other hand, I know that there was some study and some reports written about this looming threat of PFAS contamination in Michigan a number
of years ago.
And that wasn't really addressed. If you had to ask me, I guess I'd say a B.
I think that's better than most citizens would give it at this point.
I recognize that. But looking as I am at the country as a whole, there are not a lot of states that are doing more.
Tom Bruton is a scientist at the Green Science Policy Institute and has done research on cleaning up PFAS from water. Thanks very much for taking time to explain this to us.
You're welcome, Lester.
From toxic chemicals to name your poison.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. You've got your copper mug out, which generally means something to do with a Moscow mule.
Right, which uses vodka, which, as you and I talked about last time, isn't my favorite spirit. But this time we're going to use another spirit that's in a category that I don't normally drink very much from either.
All right, I can't imagine what other spirit you're avoiding.
Well, so generally I'm not very interested in flavored spirits.
Oh, yeah. I see them on the shelf at my grocery store, and I think, who's buying this?
Right. But Rusted Crow Distillery from Dearborn has one that I really, really like. It's called Ginger Devil, and it's a cinnamon whiskey. And that, you know, brings to mind visions of Fireball and, you know, makes me a little scared. But when I took my first sip, I was like, oh, no, they're doing something really refined here. It's not over the top. It's not in your face. It's just really good.
I'll have to take your word for it until I get a sip of your cocktail here, but I've always wondered, do they age these things in the barrel and then mix in some, like, cinnamon syrup, or do they put everything in the barrel and let it age together?
So I asked Andrew Starnes, who's the distiller at Rusted Crow, and he said that this includes three different types of cinnamon, ginger root, graham crackers, lemon peel, orange peel, and clove, and that they put all those botanicals in before they age it. So that goes in into the whiskey, and then I assume all gets strained out, and then that spice product goes into barrels for about 4 months. And then this is slightly sweetened, so it has some cinnamon syrup added after it comes out of the barrel.
I was afraid it was all coming out of one big like wine box thing and flavoring it. It's good to know that at least there's some thought put into it.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, what is the drink in which we're using Ginger Devil?
I just wanted to go simple with this. I talked to Andrew about it, and he said that he thought it paired really well with apple cider, and it paired really well with ginger beer, and I thought, oh, I know how to put those things together. So I've created just a simple apple cinnamon mule. So I started with 2 ounces of the Rusted Crow Ginger Devil spiced whiskey, and then I added to that 1 ounce of apple cider, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, 8 drops or so of the smoked apple chicory bitters from Black Ink Bitters, and then topped it all off with 3 ounces of ginger beer in a Moscow Mule mug over ice.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. Black Ink Bitters, last time we talked about them, they were just getting started, right?
Right. They started off as a Kickstarter, and the Kickstarter didn't even fund. But the company did go on to go into production, and they've come up with a great line of bitters. My favorite are these smoked apple chicory ones.
Well, I love to taste bitters, but of course, you know, I want to take a drink of your cocktail, but I'm a little enthused about these, so I'm going to take a drop of this and put it on the back of my hand and just take a taste of it. You hold my microphone.
That is the best way to taste bitters.
Wow.
Aren't those delicious?
They really are. I'm surprised, because bitters usually are bracing and really hard. Even a drop of them on your tongue is a lot. It's overwhelming. But that was actually a really pleasant experience.
So that's a little bit of a blessing and a curse, because those bitters that taste so overpowering when you taste them on their own, when you put them into a cocktail, just a small amount can really come through. With these, because they are a little bit gentler, you need to use more of them in the drink to really taste the bitters in the finished drink.
All right, let me take a taste of this. Copper mugs get so icy cold. You can definitely taste the cinnamon from both the bitters and the whiskey, but I was kind of expecting that kind of cloying sort of cinnamon taste out of the whiskey, but that's not what's happening here at all.
Right. It's not red hot cinnamon like we think of with Fireball. It's actual cinnamon, and it tastes like actual cinnamon, plus the ginger and the other ingredients. That's why I say it's really nuanced for a spiced whiskey.
I'll have to take a taste of that on its own sometime. Thanks very much for the drink.
Cheers.
There's more to come here on Stateside. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Did you know that only one in four kids in foster care is placed in a home with their brothers and sisters? Research shows foster children who lose contact with their siblings are more likely to develop emotional attachment disorders, feelings of isolation, and have an increased risk of self-harm. That comes from a policy report written by one of my guests. Brittany Barros is part of the 2018 Foster Youth Internship Program at the Congressional Coalition on Adoption Institute. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Scott McEachern is one of Brittany's brothers. They were separated in foster care. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Brittany, I want both of you to tell your story. What did you experience when you were separated from your siblings?
So what happens when siblings get separated, they're traumatized, right? So they're being taken away from the people that they love the most. So once they're traumatized, they start having behavioral issues. They even start having physical health issues. For example, in my case, because of being separated from my siblings, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, as well as depression. I experienced a tremendous amount of grief. Being separated for 6 years is not something that social workers or people that work with foster youth should take lightly.
How old were you?
I was about 14 years old, and we didn't get all back together until I was 20 years old, until this August.
Scott, how old were you at the time?
I don't know, probably like 9-ish.
Brittany, you got to stay with your sister for a while, but Scott was isolated from all the rest of the siblings, is that right?
Yes, that's true.
What was that like for you?
I didn't like it at all. I lived with them for a lot of my life, and then everything that I knew had to change all of a sudden.
How did that manifest itself? I mean, were you just lonely, or were you?
Well, I was lonely, of course, but it hurt me so bad that I went into major depression, major defiant behaviors. I spent a good 3 or 4 years in and out of residentials. It was hard, and I was trying to find the best way to deal with it.
Brittany, did you have any kind of contact at all with your two brothers?
So my brother, Brandon, who was in juvenile for 2 years, he was in the juvenile justice system, I did get to have contact. I did get to see him once a week. But Scott, on the other hand, who lived in Missouri for the 6 years, it really depended. For about 3 or 4 years, I got to have absolutely no contact with him, which was very devastating and very difficult. The case plan team told us that because we were both sexually abused by the same person, they didn't want us to be re-traumatized by each other. And while the intent sounds good, I just thought it was a lame excuse to keep us even more separated. And then finally, eventually, when I fought for contact with my siblings, I went to the Children's Bureau in the state of Missouri. I went to the Ombudsman office, and I finally got it to where we could write letters. And the writing letters happened for about 2 years. But me and Scott would, unfortunately, we would have to sneak contact. So we began to sneak phone contact when nobody else knew.
I finally got it to where it was supervised contact, but at least it was better than having to sneak it all the time. Don't get me wrong, I would have done it for the rest of my life until I turned 18 if I had to. But, I mean, it was just so hard.
Why do you think it's important for siblings to stay together?
Because if they're not together, then like for a temporary time when they don't have places they can go to trust, at least they can go to their sister or brother and say, hey, this is what I did. Like, I need help with this. How do I go about this? Like, they have no one. At least I'll have that one person or that two people to talk to, or however many siblings they have. They will have them people to talk to.
Also, another thing that's really important about siblings being together is because siblings have everlasting bonds that shouldn't be destroyed by a broken system. You know, these sibling bonds are important because they're the person that's going to hug you when you're crying. It's going to be the person that's going to feed you when you're starving. It's going to be the person that's going to give you a blanket at night to sleep with. Like, siblings are meant to be best friends. And when a system takes that away, what will a foster youth have left without those sibling connections?
I don't remember which one it was, but there was this Fast and Furious. One of the actors said, all you got is family. He said something a little bit different, but it was along the lines, is family matters the most.
What'd you think about when you heard that line?
I was like, yeah, that's so true. And like, they're going to be the ones there to support you. They're going to be the ones when it's hard. They're going to be the ones there. Good days, bad days, easy days. Like, it doesn't matter.
Brittany, I want to talk about some of the policy corrections that you've suggested in the report. Let's start with this idea of a sibling bill of rights, a national bill of rights. What rights would that safeguard?
If the federal law were to require a national sibling bill of rights, on a national level, it would give siblings the right to frequent visitation, to live together, and to be told why they can't live together if that were to happen. So far, about 10 states have a sibling bill of rights on their local level, but I believe siblings having the right to see each other shouldn't just be state-by-state basis. It should be on a federal level.
And I know Michigan is not one of those 10 states with a sibling bill of rights, but tell me, this report was lengthy. Your report was one of many. What are some of the other policy recommendations you're presenting?
The data system that collects data on foster care is called AFCARS. And in December 2016, the Obama administration said that there has to be new requirements on data collection within foster care. And some of this data includes how many children are in foster care, how many siblings are separated, how many kids get adopted out, what type of schooling education system they have. It's all types of data. And so in December 2016, in what is called the final rule, the Obama administration said that states must take data on siblings being separated in foster care. Well, the Trump administration reversed it and delayed it for 2 years. And this delay is really unfortunate because how are we supposed to help keep siblings together when we don't even know how states are struggling to keep siblings together? We need more data collection on that so we can understand better ways to help the system being able to keep siblings together. And so I'm urging Secretary of HHS Alexandra Azar to implement the December 2016 final rule on AFCARS and to release without delay so we can get data collection on sibling separation.
In your report, you pointed to Florida as having a model program to keep siblings together. So what are they doing in Florida?
The Neighbor to Family program, I read research on them, and they keep 98% of siblings connected in their foster care program, whereas only about 50% of foster youth get to be together in a regular foster care program on a given basis. And so what I want to happen is I want to see competitive grants coming through, funneling through federal funds to be able to put money towards programs like the Family to Neighbor program so kids can have the rights to be together. Because a 98% success rate, like, that's absolutely amazing. And I want to see other programs being able to copy and paste that model of how they are working through federal grants and federal dollars so we can actually implement models like this so siblings can be together.
The one thing that occurred to me as I was reading about this is in some cases, some families who are foster families don't have the facilities to bring in maybe four or five kids. Is that part of the problem, that if you have four kids in your family or five kids in your family, perhaps there's nobody who could take all of them at the same time?
Yeah, and that's exactly what I talked about in my report too, is lots of children are being separated from their siblings because we lack the facilities and the parents that are able to take in large groups of siblings. And that's what the Neighbor to Family program in Florida accommodates. They find foster parents and train them with high-quality training programs to teach them the importance of keeping siblings together and therefore convincing these foster parents in training to take larger groups of siblings. And that's successful in what they do. And so, yeah, I think more training for foster parents would be relevant and really helpful to making sure that siblings are connected and staying together.
I understand both of you have plans to keep working on this issue to make foster care better for siblings. Scott, how are you going to be working on this project?
Well, as soon as I do get the time, I'm going to start to write a book about my experience. And then whenever I can, I'm going to open up a nonprofit organization for foster care kids where they can come in and they can basically say whatever they want. I want that to be like their like little safe spot.
Brittany, what kind of plans do you have?
Yeah, so I currently go to school for social work. I want to be a foster care worker. And not only that, I want to be a foster parent, and I want to be one of the foster parents that take in large groups of siblings. I also plan on continuing my advocacy work that I do through nonprofit organizations. And finally, I plan on working with my local state representatives as well as my federal representatives on sibling separation and foster care. And so if you are a policymaker and you're listening to this broadcast right now, I want you to understand how important it is to keep siblings together. And I want you to be able to come up with legislation and policy to keep siblings together, such as a Sibling Bill of Rights in Michigan. And then hopefully if you're a federal policymaker, you'll get the National Sibling Bill of Rights moving through Congress.
We've been talking to Brittany Barros and Scott McEachern, a brother and sister who were separated by the foster care system, and they're now working to get policy to keep siblings together in foster care. Thanks for coming in.
No problem. Thank you.
The lame duck session of the legislature continues to surprise observers with controversial legislation. Here now to talk about that are our Friday commentators. Ken Sikkema is Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan Senate. He joins us by Skype. And Gilda Jacobs is President and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy and a former Democratic member of the Senate. Let's start with Senate Bill 1244. Public health advocates and environmentalists say this could prevent the Department of Environmental Quality from using the best and most up-to-date science to determine whether a toxic pollutant should be cleaned up. For example, DEQ could not use the federal government's most recent findings that PFAS contamination over 35 parts per trillion should be kept out of water. This bill would mean an older guideline of either 70 parts per trillion or even the previous standard of 300 parts per trillion would have to be used. Ken, this is just one example, but it could be applied to any toxic chemical polluting air, land, or water. What's the reasoning here?
This is a debate over sort of how clean is clean when it comes to environmental cleanup. What makes this bill different from some of the other lame duck bills is there's actually been a number of work groups working on this for some time, but they haven't been able to come to a resolution on which sort of data sources the DEQ can rely on. And the federal standard or the federal standards are often just not updated frequently enough, evidently. And so the DEQ wants to use a variety of other data sources and standards. But, you know, industry is saying, look, you know, we need some kind of standardization here. You know, we can't just let the agency pick and choose what standard they want or what data source they want. I think sort of the irony of this and other legislation is it's kind of a deferring to federal regulation, which is kind of an about face for Republican legislators. I think there's the ability to find some common ground here.
Gilda, as we find out there are greater concerns and potential hazards from any toxic chemical, should we wait till a federal agency gets it when it's lagging behind the known sciences?
You know, I think the most important thing is that we shouldn't even be dealing with this right now. There is so much controversy around this. And in light of the Flint water crisis, we should not be limiting our state, especially because we don't even know enough about PFAS at this point. Our water has already been contaminated and poisoned by lead all over the state, not just by Flint. And here is another situation where the strictest regulations, I think, are the most important thing to protect our families. So the fact that this is an effort to actually relax those standards, I believe, is wrong. I come from a data organization. We believe you have to look at the data. You have to look at the most up-to-date research. You have to set standards that are going to ensure our water systems are healthy, not perhaps put us in a precarious position. I honestly think this is really bad public policy, and I know that there have been work groups that have been working on this, but they haven't figured this out. I think this is something that the legislature next session should deal with. I don't want more kids and more families experiencing more poison in their drinking water.
The second bill I want to talk about is House Bill 4205. This would encompass all agencies, restricting them from making rules more strict than federal rules unless the agency can show, quote, clear and convincing, end quote, need because of exceptional circumstances. Now, I don't want to be hyperbolic here, but does clear and convincing mean people have to be sick or dying or the economy devastated by something before the state can act independent of the federal government? Ken, this has been something the Republicans have wanted for some time. What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's a bad idea. I mean, it basically says when it comes to all regulations, Michigan's going to defer to the federal government. The irony of that is it's a complete reversal of Republican philosophy in terms of longstanding belief about what's the proper relationship between the federal and state governments. Republicans historically have said states are the laboratories of democracy. The federal government is not the be-all and end-all. Wisdom doesn't always reside at the federal level, and let the states have more control and authority. And as I said, this bill does an about-face on that and says, no, we actually think the federal government is always right, and we're going to make it really hard for Michigan to go its own way. It just sort of drips with irony, in my opinion.
Gilda, should the state agencies be reined in, restricted to simply following the federal government's lead for the most part?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Ken. I think he is spot on in terms of his analysis. It asks the question, what else might be behind the fact that they're trying to push this bill? So I know that there are some folks, you know, on the Democratic side of the aisle that believe that this bill could hamstring the Whitmer administration from doing lots of different things. I would hate to think that that is really what's driving this. But again, you go back to the Flint water crisis. Things that were happening in Flint were different than what the feds were saying, you know, as well. So I see this as ironic legislation indeed, but this is a problem that does not need to be fixed.
Last week, we were all talking about the moves by the Republicans in the lame duck legislature to limit the powers of incoming Democrats, Governor-elect Gretchen Whitmer, Secretary of State-elect Jocelyn Benson, and Attorney General-elect Dana Nessel. For the most part, the Democrats have been fairly quiet about these, what many are calling power grabs by the outgoing Republican legislature. But Nessel did express some concerns about the two pieces of legislation we just discussed. And in a statement, she says, despite the lessons learned in Flint, it appears that many members of the legislature are poised to ensure that we as a state still cannot protect the very residents we serve. The question is, Ken, why until this point do you think the Democrats have been pretty quiet?
Well, I think there's a lot of armchair quarterbacking going on here about whether incoming Democratic administration should be more aggressive or less aggressive. Are they doing it, calling it about right? My personal opinion is I think they're handling this properly. There's a lot of comparison between Michigan and Wisconsin, where the incoming Democratic governor of Wisconsin is blasting Scott Walker and the legislature almost every day. But the big difference between Wisconsin and Michigan is Rick Snyder is not Scott Walker, and Scott Walker is not Rick Snyder. The Democrats are wise, in this case, the incoming administration. I think they're wise in not positioning this as an all-out partisan battle. Now, we'll see at the end of the day whether they called it right or not.
Gilda, what do you think the incoming Democrats aren't rallying the troops and protesting these so-called power grabs?
Well, it's kind of hard to say what everybody's thinking. You know, Governor-elect Whitmer ran on building bridges. I really believe that she really wants to do that with the incoming legislature. So she may be kind of keeping her powder dry so that she's not burning too many bridges with folks that she's going to have to work with come next session. That being said, I think the Republicans underestimate the memory of voters who turned out both on both sides of the aisle because they want to change. They wanted women. I mean, we had a remarkable situation where all the top positions are held by women. But I think folks want to change. And by limiting, by putting handcuffs on, you know, different branches of the government, I think it's not what the voters wanted.
Gilda Jacobs is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Hey, thanks very much.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Lester.
That is Stateside for today. Today's program was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's always causing trouble in there. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.